Hi, this is Jen Zaman, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition, host Margo Patterson speaks with Hillary Sheldon, Washington Bureau Director of the NAACP, and Representative Bobby Scott of Virginia about the efforts to get the Death in Custody Reporting Act passed and why they feel it is needed. Then, in the second half, we play an interview host Keith Brownell did with Alex Friedman of Prison Legal News about private prisons and privatization of prison services. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Margo and her guests are coming up.
Michael Brown's death last summer at the hands of the police in Ferguson, Missouri, spawned protests that forced Americans to take a closer look at police brutality, especially against people of color. Since then, other tragic occurrences of unarmed black men killed by law enforcement have brought concerns about police use of deadly force against racial minorities further to the fore. The extent of the problem is unclear because the government has not been collecting information on how many Americans died while being arrested or under police custody. The Death in Custody Reporting Act of 2013 changes that. That act passed the U.S. Senate in December 2014 and was recently signed into law by President Obama. Here to talk to us about the act is Hillary Sheldon, Director of the Washington Bureau of the NAACP, and Representative Bobby Scott. Gentlemen, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to be here with Hillary Sheldon. He does a tremendous job at the NAACP.
Wonderful. Well, Mr. Sheldon, I want to get to you in a minute because I know the NAACP was very much a promoter of this act. But, Mr. Scott, I'm hoping to start with you because I know you may need to leave a little, a few minutes early. Could you say what the legislation requires and what you hope it will achieve?
Well, the bill started off as a result of a reporter calling me and asking me if there's any information on people dying in prison. He was trying to do a report, and he suspected there were thousands of people dying in prison, but he couldn't find any information as to the cause, whether they were inmates killing inmates, guards killing inmates, medical malpractice, or whatever. And he wanted to know if there was any way we could get these deaths reported. And so I introduced the bill, and as we got going, it also occurred to us the deaths in the process of arrest would be also some good information because there's virtually no information on that. The bill actually passed in 2000, but it lasted 4 years and expired. By the time the reporting started, it expired, and we tried for several years to get it reauthorized. We finally got it reauthorized last December, and the Department of Justice is now in the process of getting the regulations and reporting process underway. But it requires just a very brief report, the fact that a death occurred, and a brief description of what happened and a little demographic background. You shouldn't be more than a half-page report. If more information is needed, the Department of Justice can follow through and ask questions. But that would give you a database of information. So when people say that white police officers are killing unarmed black men, there's really no data to support that one way or the other. And this act will add some sanity to the discussion.
So you too hope that this will provide some hard data. Are there any estimates now of how many people are being killed by the police per year?
Well, first, this is Hillary Sheldon, and I do want to thank Congressman Scott for his leadership in getting this done. It was such a common-sense piece of legislation that, for some reason, policies have held back on providing the data. our hope is that as the adage goes, in order to manage a problem, you must first measure it. So having active, engaged, and comprehensive data is absolutely crucial, particularly on something as serious and significant as someone losing their life while in the hands of our law enforcement officials. And Congressman Scott is absolutely right. With the data we'll be able to collect now, once we're able to get the regulations straightened out and guidances with the Justice Department, we'll include information on why the person was being detained in the first place, what the person's race, perceived race, ethnicity, national origin, age grouping, what they were actually doing at the time. All those pieces of information are very, very helpful. And what's extremely crucial in this bill is it actually collects the data from every jurisdiction and state in a more organized fashion, that is more uniform, so we can compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges and find ways to actually cut down on the deaths, as you mentioned earlier, particularly as we're looking at the disparities as they appear in racial and ethnic minorities, including African Americans dying in police custody.
Mr. Scott, you mentioned, Representative Scott, you mentioned that you had tried to introduce, or at least perhaps you didn't mention it, but I know that you did try to introduce this legislation into the House of Representatives several times before it finally passed. Why was it so difficult to get the bill reauthorized?
Well, we were able to get it reauthorized with the overwhelming votes in the House. It would just get over to the Senate, and, you know, the Senate is the Senate. And we just couldn't get it passed. You know, there'd be one person objecting, and then you know they wouldn't know what to do, and the you know the end of the session would come, and the bill hadn't passed. We were able to get it. One of my friends over there said that the Senate works on unanimous consent and exhaustion, and they hadn't gotten exhausted yet, but we were able to get unanimous consent this time.
Well, excellent. And I understand this is kind of a rare instance of bipartisan legislation passing, that you had both the support of Republicans and Democrats. Is that true?
Yeah,
that is true.
Well, it was unanimous consent.
It was an amazing thing to see.
In the House,
I believe all of them believed there was a problem.
On the Judiciary Committee, and in fact, it passed the votes in the House. We either voice votes overwhelming support. So we didn't have any problem getting it reauthorized in the House. It was just the Senate procedures that held it up for about five or six years. And we finally got it passed. We're having the Department of Justice is going to have a briefing to explain exactly what the process is in terms of reports and what they intend to do to make sure that the bill is working.
Mr. Shelton, did you say
that's going to be in? That's going to be in about 2 weeks.
Mr. Shelton, were you trying to say something?
Oh no, I was just disagreeing with the congressman that being able to get through with some clarity to both sides of the aisle was absolutely crucial. It was also really empowering to see the House take the initiative initially along these lines. We've seen challenges before with those who would hold it up, and Congressman Scott is absolutely right. You know, the rules of engagement in the Senate are quite different. One senator can decide that there is something or some problem, something they're not clear on in a piece of legislation, and actually stop it from moving forward. So it really took even an 11th-hour push to make sure that all the information senators needed on both sides of the aisle were very clear what the bill did and, quite frankly, what the bill doesn't do, to be able to move it through as we did and, of course, finally move it to the president's desk for signature at the very end of the lame duck session last year.
When you say what the bill doesn't do, were there what was it that senators were concerned about the bill not doing?
If there was one issue that kind of led the way in their concerns, it was how much it cost.
That it did anything. And it might cost something, but I think the cost is really virtually no cost because the information, a lot of the information the Department of Justice is trying to get now. And so the Department of Justice reported that the bill could be essentially enacted and implement it with no additional appropriations.
Did the death of Michael Brown and the publicity that followed it, was that a factor in making it easier to pass this bill?
Well, like I said, it passed overwhelmingly several years, for three Congresses in a row. And it was originally enacted well before that happened. But I think some of the protests may have persuaded the couple of senators that were thinking about putting a hold on it. You saw the signs out there, Black Lives Matter, you didn't want signs and Senator so-and-so doesn't think Black Lives count. There was a rally coming to Washington, D.C. Towards the end of the session, and you never know why people change their minds. But we did point out to some of the staffers who we were talking to that they didn't want to see their senator's name on those placards. So the fact that the protests were coming to Washington may have helped. You just don't know. I mean, we had a lot of people, the NAACP, a lot of my Republican friends were calling members of the Senate that were concerned. And you never know what actually did it. You take all these shots in the dark, and all you know is something hit. And we were able to achieve unanimous consent in the Senate.
Well, obviously you both are hopeful that you will get some good data from the Death in Custody Reporting Act. What do you think?
Some of the things that we're going to get, we're not only going to get just a brief description, but the Department of Justice is supposed to study the data to see if there are any patterns. I mean, a few years ago, unfortunately, there was some discussion as to whether it was a chokehold that was the problem in the New York case. But they studied a lot of deaths and found that that was the reason why a lot of people were dying, and they decided to prohibit police officers from using that particular technique. Some may be training, but if you study the deaths, you can try to find out what can be done to reduce the incidence of people dying in police custody. A lot of them, if you get some suspects shooting at the police, there's not much you can do about those. But others where the person is found to be unarmed, and there may be some training or that could reduce the number. And you can't do the training, as Hillary said, without knowing what the problem is. What was the incidence? We don't even know for sure that it's white officers killing unarmed black men. I mean, it could be it's just not reported as much, but what we're going to do is get definitive evidence as to what the situation is.
So you think that this will have a substantive impact on police behavior?
Well, the discussion now is the accusation is that white police officers are killing unarmed black men, and somebody says, well, how many? And then the conversation just disintegrates into name-calling because we don't have any information. We'll be able to show the patterns, maybe some police departments, that do decent training don't have this problem. Others without the training, or maybe some screening of police officers in the hiring process. We don't know because we don't have the information. But once we get the information, and the numbers may well be in the thousands, and that will give you a substantial database with which to look to see what the problem is and come up with some solutions. You may find that in the overwhelming portion of the cases, they're unavoidable. And if that's the case, then we would certainly have found that out.
Mr. Sheldon, I want to bring you in on this. I know the NAACP wanted to see this legislation passed for a long time. How long have you at the NAACP been advocating for this?
Well, it's been for years and years. Quite frankly, from the very beginning of my tenure at the NAACP, we've seen the need for the collection of this kind of data, and which goes back almost 18 years. as the congressman was saying a little earlier, we've had pieces of the data before, and it passed the bill once before. But at this point, being able to have the more specific data organized to be able to look at, again, the trends, the patterns of what's going on across the country, and most importantly, begin crafting some solutions. Look, it is the NAACP sees that this really is the epitome of insanity not to have a major tool to collect data when we're seeing so many of these cases on television. And, of course, we get reports all the time from our communities. I can talk about cases going back to even one of our founding members, W.B. Du Bois, saying that the massive challenge of the African-American community is crime and the criminal justice system, even recognizing in 1914 that there were concerns. Moving up to today, looking at what is happening now, I mean, when we watch a 12-year-old kid shot on a playground while playing with a toy gun, and we see the police officer for some reason perceives that if you're black, 12, on a playground, that somehow or another that toy has to be real, and we've got to address it with the kind of summarily implementation that they did, that is, shooting that kid twice after 2 seconds arriving on the scene. Or we see cases of a man in a Toledo, Ohio Walmart walking around the store playing with the toy gun he picked up while walking through the store waiting for his family. And the presumption being that somehow or another the law enforcement person that came in would not confront or talk to him, but just line up behind him and shoot him twice in the back without any interactions. You know, being able to gather all that data and see just how pervasive it is and how broad the patterns are. I think Congressman is right. The NAACP looks at these issues, and we know that there have been some questionable shootings by black police officers as well as white police officers and others as well. Having this data, as we see it, gives us that foundation to begin working to change the system itself. There's something wrong in a system in which this happens so often. And as we see it, police officers are able to get away by simply saying that their perception of what was going on was life-threatening. Though I think when most of us looked at the video, what we saw was the person whose life was taken running in the other direction, or the person being shot twice in the back while sitting there, or, again, a 12-year-old kid playing with a toy on a playground. But again, for some reason, the police officer came in as he did. And in the final assessment of those cases, of course, their supervisors, the captains or chiefs of police there, all say that the police officers acted in a manner in accordance with their policies. Well, it tells us there's a problem with those policies, and addressing those problems really have to be something that's driven by data. This bill or this new law collects that data.
A question about the enforcement. You know, you mentioned a previous bill had passed in 2000, and yet it seemed to be very difficult for them to actually get the data. And there's an article by Mother Jones says, if past measures to collect similar data are any indication, it's going to be a long time before Washington reliably keeps a comprehensive database. And this article refers to the fact that the original Death and Custody Reporting Act never was really able to compel the data that it was seeking to collect. That it never really received that from law enforcement. What in this new measure is going to lead to more effective reporting?
Well, there's a provision in it that you'll lose some federal funds if you don't report, but I think if the Justice Department follows the news and a lot of the deaths are very prominent in the news, to make sure they are reporting and to notify all law enforcement agencies. Just about every agency gets some kind of federal funds, so it's a condition of getting the federal funds. As they get the federal funds, they need to be reminded of their responsibility to make the reports. The Department of Justice is aggressive in reminding people of their responsibility. I think we'll get the reports. I mean, they're not that a law enforcement agency shouldn't have that many reports to do. I mean, you know, when I initially introduced it, they said, well, that's an administrative burden on the locality. And you say, well, if you're killing so many people are dying in your custody, there's more the reason to have the reports. I mean, there's not much to do that's not already there. I mean, you can just Xerox the police incident report. Would probably contain all the information that's needed and just fax it up to Washington. And it shouldn't that occur. It shouldn't be that much of an occurrence. And so, if the Department of Justice is aggressive in reminding people of their responsibility, I think we'll get a lot of data. And if you get some people that just won't report, there is a provision that they'll lose some of their federal funds. But that is the purpose of it isn't to save money in federal funds. The purpose of it is to get the information. And so, I think the Department of Justice, if they're doing what they need to do, will be able to get the information.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, KKFI, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Representative Bobby Scott and Hillary Shelton, Director of the Washington Bureau of the NAACP, about the recent passage of the Death in Custody Reporting Act. Mr. Shelton, you mentioned that if you look at some of the recent videos of people who have been killed, one certainly gets the impression that there's a culture of impunity that may prevail in some police departments. What do you think is going to be most effective in remedying police misconduct? Is it legislation, body cameras, community pressures, police chiefs who insist on better conduct from their officers, the successful prosecution of police officers? I'm curious what you and Representative Scott think is going to be key in resolving some of these issues that the Michael Brown and Eric Garner's death highlighted.
It really is going to take all of the above. We count on our police officers to provide very comprehensive services in our communities. They do everything from serving to protecting. All that's a very big part of what we hold them accountable for doing and a very big part of why they're hired in the first place, quite frankly. Being able to make sure that, number one, the policies are clear on their engagements. At what point is it acceptable to use various levels of force? And it will also really push us to look at the options that police officers have to actually apprehend a suspect. And we're reminded that those that are stopped by police or are apprehended in any way by police are suspects in the commission of some crime or other infractions. So it's going to require good policy. It's going to require good training based on that policy. At what time do you, when you interact with someone who is mentally disturbed, pull out your taser or some other form of non-lethal policing tool to be able to, again, stop them or apprehend them in those situations? And at what point does it become necessary to utilize deadly force? That we've seen very recently on television, a police officer being held for, even as a man continued to approach him and taunt him and so forth, to not pull the trigger and shoot him. Though many would say under our present policies, it would have been acceptable for him to actually pull that trigger. And then finally, after training, police officers have to be held accountable, like everyone else. You know, they are paid public servants. They're given a job to do. If we are not describing clearly what that job is, then shame on us. And so part of the challenge really has to be for us to make sure that we're training those police officers in a manner that's consistent with the values of our country and the communities they're serving, but also when they step out of line, to be able to have a very trustworthy approach to assess what the police officers are doing. We believe very strongly in things like police accountability review boards that have real power and not these various advisory committees that are in place across the country, but those that have the independence and power to bring a police officer in when they're misbehaving, have been independent in their funding, and having the authority and power to compel an indictment in cases that are extremely problematic, but address lesser issues as well to help improve our police effectiveness and abilities throughout the country. So it takes all of the above.
Margaret, let me just add to that, because one of the things we're trying to do is to identify the problem so we'll know exactly which solutions, proposals may be necessary. Body cameras, good to show what happened. We saw in the South Carolina case that but for the video, the description of what happened was vastly different from what the video showed. The training, particularly on what's called implicit bias, that is the kind of subconscious bias. People have to be able to recognize what that is and how to deal with it. But also hiring, making sure that the police reflect the community. I mean, you will treat these people differently when you are from the community than if you're from the outside and these are just a bunch of strangers. Your attitude towards them is entirely different. So hiring, making sure the police force is part of the community. Is extremely important.
I'm curious whether you think the mistrust that seems to exist between law enforcement and the black community, whether it's always been as bad as it seems to be now. Was the situation ever better, or has it always been deplorable and white Americans were just unconscious of the problem?
Well, in some areas it's good, in some areas it's bad, and it's something you just have to work on. And part of it is hiring. There's a concept of community policing where the police officers get into the community and get to know the people well. You can do a much better job. You get much better information. People are much more willing to. You get this campaign, Don't Snitch, where people refuse to cooperate with the police in terms of solving crimes. Well, that's about the most counterproductive situation you can have. You want if you want crime solved, people are going to have to say what they know. But they're not going to say what they know if they don't trust the police, if they don't know the police officers. Community policing, having police officers be part of the community and the community policing technique will go a long way. I mean, they say that when these explosions occurred in certain communities, you needed two elements. You needed a spark, but you also needed the gasoline. And in a lot of communities, the police force has such goodwill in the community, when something bad happens, there is no explosive reaction. The police department deals with it appropriately. We had a situation in my district in Norfolk where there was a situation, the police officer was fired. There weren't any protests because we trusted the police to do the right thing. You had the spark, but you did not have the explosion. Others, where you don't have that good relationship, when things happen as they always do, you always have an explosion because they don't trust the police. They don't like the police. The police don't treat them with respect. And the gasoline is just there waiting for the spark.
You know, I strongly agree with the congressman. You know, the NAACP happens to be 106 years old, and it's amazing how the challenges of police-community relations have been a problem for so long. W.B. Du Bois said what I mentioned earlier in 1914, but even Martin Luther King mentioned in 1963 at his as the March on Washington, that he knows that people coming to that march had to deal with unruly police officers. Now, I'm paraphrasing saying it that way, but that's in essence what he said in his speech. And if we move on to the NAACP's Beyond the Rodney King report that was done after Rodney King was so savagely beaten by those police officers, they were caught on video, and in many of the cases now, I will say that video reporting has helped tremendously in America being able to see just how pervasive the problem is. And as always, our country steps up to the plate to address the concern when the concern is presented squarely before us. What we're seeing with the Eric Garner video, what we're seeing with the videos from other shootings across the country, is the real problems that are there. You know, even the case of the reserve officer more recently shooting an African American in the back after he was held down, saying he grabbed the wrong weapon. I thought I was grabbing my taser, and I grabbed my gun and killed him. The video helped make the true difference as we begin to move as a country to now hopefully solve this awful problem that's been such a scourge for so long.
Well, Representative Scott, Hillary Shelton, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. Our time is up, I'm afraid, but we very much appreciate you being here to talk about the Death in Custody Reporting Act.
Thank you, Margo.
It's great being with you.
Thank you.
Now, the calendar for the week of April 20th, 2015. April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. The public is invited to experience a provocative stage production aimed at raising awareness on the prevalence of child abuse. The case for Camp Choice is about a fictitious lawsuit focused on many counts against the world for poor conditions in government, education, parenting, and social responsibility. The cast of youth and supporting adult actors will depict a variety of real-life characters that make major decisions having global impacts. The case for Camp Choice will be presented Sunday, April 26th, 4 p.m. at Paseo High School, 4747 Flora, KCMO. For tickets and more information, go to www.campchoicekc.com or call Janae at 816-560-0977. The Veterans Administration is streamlining the claims and appeals process to deliver benefits faster and more accurately. The new system went online March 25th. You can electronically file or find the necessary forms to fill out at www.va.gov. You will be able to find a disability claim, apply for health care benefits, housing benefits, education and training, and more at this site. That's www.va.gov. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
Welcome to the Jaws of Justice. My name is Keith Brown here. One out of every 147 people in America are currently confined in penal institutions and county jails. This is in excess of 2 million people, and this country has more individuals confined than any other nation on this earth. Despite the high number of incarcerated persons, it seems to be having no effect as far as the reduction of crime is concerned. And the cost of keeping this many people confined is putting an enormous strain on our economy. One solution that many states are turning to, however, is prison privatization. So today, our guest, Mr. Alex Friedman from Nashville, Tennessee, will be talking to us by way of telephone interview to explain why private prisons are not such a good idea. Good afternoon to you, sir, and welcome to our show.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, before we get into the subject matter of this interview, would you please give our audience a little bit of background about yourself?
Absolutely. I serve as associate editor of a publication called Prison Legal News, and Prison Legal News has been covering corrections and criminal justice-related issues for the past 22 years as a print publication. The PLN is a project of the Human Rights Defense Center, where I also serve as associate director. Additionally, I am president of a nonprofit called the Private Corrections Institute, which is a citizen watchdog organization that educates the public and policymakers about the hazards and pitfalls of privatizing correctional services. And for full disclosure purposes, I am also a former prisoner who served time in the 1990s in both public and privately operated facilities in Tennessee.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, are you able to tell us how many private prisons there are in America today?
Well, the number of prisons, no, because nobody really tracks that. You'd have to kind of piece that together. But the number of prisoners incarcerated in private prisons, the last statistics from the Department of Justice indicated there were about 129,000 prisoners in privately operated lockups in the U.S. That does not include all of them, though. That doesn't include juveniles held in privately operated secure juvenile facilities, nor does it include inmates who are held in privatized civil commitment centers or immigration detainees held in privately operated, such as ICE detention facilities. So it understates the number, but the number is certainly over 130,000.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Corrections Corporation of America?
Yes, I'm very familiar with CCA. Corrections Corporation of America is a Nashville-based company, for-profit corporation, that is the nation's largest private prison operator. So CCA operates around 66 facilities nationwide, has about 90,000 beds just in this one company alone. It took in approximately $1.7 billion in gross revenue last year. And they control in excess of 50% of the private prison market in the United States.
Okay. Do you have any connection with the corporation?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any connection with that corporation?
Well, yes, in several ways. I spent time as an inmate in a CCA-operated facility in Tennessee from around 1992 to 1998, so I had some firsthand empirical experience with how the company operates and kind of what their facilities are like from an insider's point of view. I've also extensively researched the company since then. I'm very familiar with its history and with its current operations. And lastly, I am a shareholder of CCA. I own a small amount of stock that allows me to attend their shareholder meetings and to introduce shareholder resolutions.
Mm-hmm. I see. Does the private prison industry exist on the federal level as well as the state?
It does. The private prison industry actually reaches into government operations on a number of levels. So they operate, for example, municipal and county jails in some jurisdictions. They contract with state Department of Corrections in numerous states. And they do contract on the federal level with three federal agencies, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons, which houses federal inmates, the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which houses primarily immigration detainees, and with the U.S. Marshals Service, which incarcerates pretrial detainees who are pending charges in federal court.
I'm assuming you heard my introduction where I was talking about the 2 million plus people we have confined in America today. So what I would like to ask you is, what would you say to those in our audience who believe that private prisons are now necessary because of the sheer number of people who are confined?
Well, I would say first we need to look and see whether we need to be confining that number of people in the first place, rather than trying to find places to put them or try to make our mass incarceration efforts more cost-effective. Because the fact is, in the U.S., we do have around 2.3 million people locked up in state and federal and county facilities, prisons and jails, basically, which is an enormous number. And that number is dwarfed by more people who are on probation and parole. That's around 6 million. Plus, you have millions more who were incarcerated but are no longer under supervision and have been released but have felony convictions.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people who are involved in our correction system is pretty extensive. It's around 3% of the entire U.S. population. And the question is, should our laws, should our criminal justice policies result in that type of outcome? Because a lot of the people who are locked up are low-level drug dealers and nonviolent offenders who might be better served with sanctions such as community work placement or substance abuse treatment or electronic supervision in the community, for example, where they could still work and then pay restitution to their victims. When they're locked up, you really don't have that kind of dynamic. You're simply warehousing them in prisons at the public expense. Now, that might be appropriate, you know, for very dangerous offenders who commit violent crimes, but around half the inmates that are locked up are not convicted of violent offenses. So before even looking at whether private prisons are an effective solution to overcrowding, first we need to look and see why our prison system is overcrowded in the first place and what we might be able to do about that.
Okay, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm a former prisoner myself. Could you tell us what type of impact does private prisons have on society at large?
That's a really good question, because people can look at the concept and they tend to get bogged down with things like, well, does it cost less? Or is it morally proper to allow private companies to profit from keeping people in prison? But the point that you mentioned is probably the most important, which is this good for society as a whole? are our communities made safer, and do they benefit from prison privatization? And to answer that, I'm kind of going to go back to our to the previous question about mass incarceration and why we have so many people locked up. The reason partly we have a lot of people locked up is we have very punitive sentencing laws in the United States. So we have mandatory minimum laws. We have truth in sentencing laws. We have three strikes and you're out laws. And these laws are all very politically popular, and they kind of resonate with the public. But what they've done is they've created a huge, massive, bloated prison system that is increasingly very expensive to operate. And our budget system is a zero-sum game. Every dollar that's spent on prisons is a dollar we can't spend on education, health care, affordable housing, take your pick, you know, any of the other very socially important things that taxpayers pay for. So the impact on society of the private prison industry is that the private prison industry has kind of perpetuated our model of mass incarceration by providing additional bed space. If states and the federal government did not have private prisons to rely upon to house all of their excess prisoners, then they would have to address those very tough questions of who are we incarcerating and how much is this costing and whether this is good public policy and socially beneficial. They don't have to ask or answer those questions so long as they can say, hey, we have more inmates than we have beds for. We'll simply hire a private company and pack them into those beds, and then we won't have to deal with those larger issues. And that's really the insidious nature of the private prison industry. It has made it very difficult for corrections and criminal justice reform in the United States.
I see. This is Keith Brownhill, and you're listening to the Jaws of Justice on KKFI Community Radio 90.1 FM. Today I'm speaking with Mr. Alex Friedman, President of the Private Corporation, Private Corrections Institution, and the Associate Director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Now, could you elaborate a little bit on what type of impact private prisons have on the people who serve time in them?
Sure. To some extent, there's not a lot of difference to prisoners who are serving time in private prisons, because when you're serving time, regardless of who's running the prison, you're still incarcerated.
Right.
And you're still serving time. And some prisoners don't really distinguish between the two, whether it's a state prison guard or a private prison guard with Acme Incorporated on a shoulder. Either way, you're still locked up.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some significant differences in how public prisons are run as compared to private prisons. And it stems from the fact that private prisons have to generate profit. That's their job.
Right.
You know, that's why private corporations exist, is to make money. So whereas public prisons, their goals are to protect the public safety, to punish offenders according to the laws of the state, and hopefully to rehabilitate offenders so when they get out, they don't victimize more people in the community, they don't reoffend. Those are all very worthy public service goals of our public prisons. Private prisons, however, are not accountable to the public. They are accountable to shareholders and corporate executives because they're private corporations, just like General Motors or Exxon or Walmart. So they're not looking out for the public good. They're looking out for their private interests, and those interests are strictly monetary. So some of the differences are that private prisons are operated as profit-generating ventures, whereas public prisons are not. So in the private prison industry, you have various cost-cutting measures because you have to reduce expenses in order to generate profit.
Mm-hmm.
So they will, in general, on average, they will hire fewer staff, they will pay them less, they will offer them fewer benefits with less training, and they have higher vacancy rates and higher staff turnover. All of that saves the company money. When you pay your employees less and you have fewer employees and give them fewer benefits, you're cutting your payroll costs, which means you're generating more profit. Your bottom line is increasing. But what that business model does is it makes their facilities more dangerous. Because you have fewer staff that don't have as much training, and you have higher staff turnover, which means greater instability. So the private prison business model creates environments where violence and problems such as riots and homicides and escapes and even sexual assaults tend to be more likely to occur. And the research has borne that out. The research has indicated that private prisons have higher violent incident rates than their public counterparts.
That was my next question for you, but do you have any insight into what's being done to try to correct those problems?
Yes, and the answer is very little. Once governments contract with a private company to operate their prisons, they take basically a hands-off approach. That is, they've paid a company to provide this service. They expect the company to do it. The company's being paid to do it. And the government really kind of washes its hands of it. Now, that's what it is in practice. On paper, there's a monitoring process. And so the government agencies will have monitors on site at the facility who are presumably looking over the shoulder of the private prison contractor and making sure they're following the contract. Time and time again, though, what's been found is that this monitoring process is grossly inefficient. You might have one or two state monitors at a facility housing thousands of prisoners, and they're there during eight-hour shifts during the day. They mostly stay in their office, and they rely almost exclusively on data and reports and information they get from the contractor. So, in essence, the contractor is almost policing itself, and there's very little government oversight. Without oversight, there's really no incentive or ability to change some of the problems that exist in private prisons.
In most of these, those prisons you're speaking of, there's double celling that takes place, right?
Correct. A lot of prisons are double cells where you have two inmates housed in one cell, usually about 8 by 10 foot, although that is, of course, prevalent, highly prevalent in public prisons as well as private prisons.
Mm-hmm. And the double celling situations or where most of the violence takes place. Is that correct?
That I'm not sure. I think violence takes place in a lot of areas. I mean, it's not just in the cells.
Right.
You have violence on the recreation yards. You have it in the dining halls where inmates congregate for meals, in gymnasiums and so on. I would say, though, that when you have two inmates in a cell, you are obviously increasing greatly increasing the possibility of violence between those inmates. When you have one inmate in a cell, it's kind of hard for him to get into a fight with himself.
Right.
So obviously when you are increasing the number of inmates in one location, you are inherently increasing the likelihood that something bad might happen.
Okay. Could you briefly tell me whether or not you feel that the hidden cost of incarcerating nonviolent offenders has been worth uprooting them from their homes and their families? And what happens to these people when they will ultimately return and have fewer opportunities?
That's a complex question, and a lot of people don't think about those kind of consequences. To address it, first I would say when people talk about prisons and prisoners, they tend to have this perception that, well, everybody locked up first is a really bad, violent person, you know, who has, you know, committed murder or rape or armed robbery or some very serious crime. And as I mentioned earlier, that's not the case. At least half of the inmates who are locked up are there for nonviolent crimes, property crimes, drug crimes, and so on, a lot of them very low level. And people that can be locked up can be incarcerated from everything from, you know, traffic violations and kiting bad checks to trespassing and burglary, in addition to all those more serious crimes, which, of course, also occur. But people tend to have a skewed view of who is in prison. In particular, when you have low-level offenders and you're mixing them in prison with career criminals, gang members, very violent prisoners, that creates a negative environment where low-level offenders can basically learn, just like they're at a university, if you will, of crime, you know, how to commit additional types of really bad offenses, and that's not a good thing.
I see.
Additionally, there's very little rehabilitative programs that is offered in our correction system. About 80% of people who are locked up have substance abuse or alcohol problems that directly contributed to their crimes.
Okay.
But we don't offer in our prison system substance abuse treatment programs except for a very small percentage of those who need it. So we're not offering the programs that inmates need to help themselves stay out, get sober, rehabilitate themselves. So when they get out, they don't commit more crimes.
Okay. Could you briefly give us your contact information, because we're almost out of time. I did enjoy this interview immensely, and I think you have some good information from the public, and they will need to know how to get in touch with you, those who are concerned.
Sure. Our main website is www.prisonlegalnews.org. So that's prisonlegalnews.org. And our contact information is available on our website, and we would certainly like to hear from people who would like to make some follow-up questions or comments.
Okay. Mr. Friedman, I certainly appreciate you coming on the show, and I thank you for your time. And we hope that today somebody has learned something that might change their attitude and their mind about people who are incarcerated. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for having me. Pleasure being with you.
Yes, sir.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The drug war is ending, slow, ugly, and bloody all over the world. This report comes to us courtesy of the BBC.
Sarah Amenzo and her family are running out of time. She has stage 4 cancer. The chemotherapy isn't working, and the doctors say there's nothing more they can do.
I watch women die every day. I watch children bury their moms. So I know what is in front of me, and I'm doing everything I can to prevent that. Left with no options, everybody speaks about cannabis oil. It's a natural option that the government's ignoring, and I want to live. I have to live.
Cannabis has been used as a medicine for centuries. It's legal in half U.S. states, and Britain's leading cancer research group is interested.
Cannabinoids are certainly very interesting molecules, and there's a lot of research. There's hundreds of papers being published looking at their chemical properties against cancer cells. Turning that into effective treatments is a long road, and certainly it's not going to be the one cure for cancer, because nothing is.
So this is how you're able to gauge what level of activity is going on in your body.
Stephanie LaRue says she has evidence, and it is backed up by her doctor.
The cannabis works. No chemo. I only did cannabis, and the tumors are gone. And the scans I have is evidence and proof of that. Kind of like, what more do you need?
A lot more, according to one of the world's leading cancer doctors.
Until somebody proves it, whether it be the manufacturers who put together a clinical trial, whether it be doctors who get government funding to do it, or patients who say, here are my records, and let's put it in a medical journal and be transparent with what I had, what I was treated with, and what my outcome was, then until that, it's snake oil.
So what is the evidence? Well, there are hundreds of lab reports that have been published. A study on mice which showed that it worked. A human trial that saw 8 out of 9 patients respond to treatment, even though they all did die in the time you might expect. Dozens of charities and organizations are starting to think there's something in it. Making the oil is still an underground industry. The cannabis is legal. The flammable solvents he's using aren't.
So this is the finished product?
Yeah, this is the finished product.
And it's what Sarah Amento is trying.
I squeeze out a very little amount, and then I believe it's the best option. I've seen it work for others, and I'm hoping it'll work for me.
It is her only hope, but it is also unproven medicine. Alice Aliza, BBC News.
Not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Ready? 1, 2, 3.
Do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not. We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday. Tell somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
Gonna make myself a better man.